Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone.
We see only a few miles of ruffled snow, bounded by a vague, wavy horizon. But we know that beyond that horizon are hundreds and even thousands of miles which can offer no change to the weary eye. One knows there's neither tree, nor shrub, nor any living thing, nor even an animate rock. Nothing but this terrible, limitless expanse of snow. It has been so for countless years, and it will be so for countless more. And we, little human insects, have started to crawl over this awful desert. Could anything be more terrible than this silent, windswept immensity?
That's a diary entry written by explorer Robert Falcon Scott on his journey to Antarctica in 1905. It was, in the end, a disastrous journey. Scott wasn't properly prepared. He had hauled along tractors, ponies, and even hay to feed the ponies onto the ice. He and his men reached the South Pole, but all died on the trip back. Scott was, you might say, the intrepid loser. Impractical, indomitable, sort of crazy, and sort of heroic. But he felt a need to explore, a need that humans have always had and always will have, no matter how seemingly impossible the quest. 50 years after Scott's expedition, another group of explorers, much better prepared, also took a journey to Antarctica, part of an unprecedented global scientific effort to investigate the continent. It was called the IGY, the International Geophysical Year. On today's Soundprint, as part of our special series, Pole to Pole, producer Barbara Bogave takes us back to feel what it was like to live and work on Scott's silent, windswept immensity.
The giant rockets that will launch Earth's first artificial moon are already in production as the International Geophysical Year opens. The satellite is ready.
From 1957 to 1958, the International Geophysical Year sent hundreds of scientists to Antarctica. Many were just grad students. They traded in their slide rules for Army-issue parkas and ended up facing some of the same hazards that had challenged and at times doomed famous polar explorers like Robert Falcon Scott and Admiral Byrd. But their stories are barely known. Like Phil Smith.
My nickname was Crevasse Smith. However, Admiral Dufek called me Smitty.
John Barrett.
I'd been interested in Antarctica since a child. I went down for the adventure and romance of it, but I didn't realize that adventures only happen when someone makes a mistake.
Charlie Bentley.
I was a graduate student at Columbia University doing marine geophysics back in the early 1950s when the IGY was on the horizon, and one of the organizers for the IGY Antarctic program had his office right across the hall from where I was. So he came across the hall. He said, who would like to go to the Antarctic?
And New Zealander, Tony Gow.
I'd never seen a snowflake in my life before. In fact, I finishing a degree in volcanology.
Never seen a snowflake. Imagine. Some of these young guys had only encountered ice or mountains on camping trips with the Boy Scouts. But this moment in Cold War history turned them into scientist adventurers. Each came to the Antarctic by a different route. At some point during the U.S. Navy's run-up to the IGY, the top brass realized they didn't have anyone who knew how to do things like move heavy machinery across snow and ice. Navy personnel had gone with Admiral Byrd on his expeditions in the Antarctic, but back then they used dog sleds, not snow tractors. Then somebody remembered Smitty, the young ROTC kid in the Arctic who knew all about getting across the ice cap.
From Rear Admiral George Dufek, to the Admiral of the Pacific Fleet, to the Secretary of the Navy, to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Admiral Dufek, George Dufek, who was the commander of the Naval Task Force, sent me a message to Greenland. I was out in the middle of the ice cap in a snowstorm at the time, hunkered down for 3 or 4 days.
Army Corps Commander, to the Army Division Commander, to the Army Brigade Commander.
All this came by Morse code. My radio operator said, because of the formalities of it, it went all the way up through the chain of command to the Secretary of Navy, to the Secretary of the Army, and all the way back down through the Army to me. And my radio operator was copying all this down. He said, Lieutenant, I've never gotten a message like this. I think war has been declared.
Invite you to be part of IGY team in Antarctica. Stop. Assignment, create a safe trail for overland tractor traverse to build Byrd Station. Stop.
So I immediately sent a message back saying, yes, I will do it. It took me 1 minute to make the decision.
In 1957, vast parts of Antarctica were still a mystery. Very little was known about the continent, and very little was known about the scientific properties of the ice. Mapping and investigating the ice was one of the main goals of the IGY. John Barrett.
We didn't even have maps of all of the coastline, much less the interior of the ice sheet. We didn't know how high it was or how thick it was, how much snow fell, whether it's increasing or decreasing. In fact, this is still a strongly debated question, although we have learned a great deal about it.
We were interested in, for example, the crystal structure of the ice.
Glaciologist Tony Gow.
How does it change with depth, and what does it tell us about the deformation of the ice? Now, it turns out that ice is a mineral. It's one mineral rock. It's crystalline, and it is a hexagonal mineral.
Today, Tony Gow is one of the leading authorities on glaciology, but in the 1950s, he was in New Zealand studying volcanoes.
Fire to ice. Essentially, that's what it was. Went from fire to ice and never got back to volcanology.
You'd never seen a snowflake. How did you know you could even deal with extreme cold?
Well, nobody really does. Most people get into this game purely by accident. They don't consciously get a degree in the subject like glaciology. You actually gravitate towards it. You talk to people, you find something out about a project or a program, and so you gravitate into a situation accidentally.
Had you had any experience?
I had no experience.
In ice or snow?
I had no experience in ice, but I knew I liked cold weather.
Geophysicist Charlie Bentley.
And I had some interest in the Antarctic from reading Mr. Popper's Penguins when I was a kid. Well, Mr. Popper was somebody who lived in the U.S., but he was a great fan of Admiral Byrd's. And he got in touch. He somehow managed to get some penguins sent from the Antarctic to his house in the U.S. That's about all I remember of that story, but it's been 70 years since I read it. But I was a bit at loose odds. I didn't have a good thesis project. So when I agreed to go to the Antarctic, my job was to go to Greenland and train myself how to do it. And I also got a PhD thesis topic out of it. And then the day after I defended my thesis, I left for the Antarctic.
Remember, these were the days before polar fleece, before GPS, before snowmobiles even. Phil Smith was in charge of getting all the scientists and Navy personnel safely through the crevasses to the site where they would build Byrd Station, the major base in the interior of West Antarctica. The idea was to prepare a relatively safe trail to Byrd, even for tractor trains hauling heavy building supplies. So the question was, which route posed the least danger of sending the men down a crevasse? Now, these cracks in the polar ice are treacherous. Often they're invisible. They get covered over by ice and snow. Phil Smith.
We did a lot of aerial reconnaissance for a period of 2 weeks. We looked at the whole eastern side of the Ross Ice Shelf, and then we gambled. We found a place that was terrible, 7 or 8 or 9 miles of absolute one crevasse right after another. But from there all the way to Byrd Station, another 450 miles, was clear sailing. There were no crevasses. If we could get through this spot, we were almost assured that we would get the trail laid out and get everything out to Byrd Station to build it.
One of the new technologies they did have was the crevasse detector. It was an unwieldy contraption mounted on the front of the snowcats. The detector sends an electric current through the ice. If the current is interrupted by a void, that breaks the signal. And the meter readings in the snowcat suddenly drop. They go berserk, and there's your danger sign. That's how it was supposed to work anyway. Seismologist Ed Robinson.
Only ones that ever detected were the ones that it broke into. And when you're traveling along, and oftentimes the first two snowcats will pass over the crevasse, and the third one breaks in.
But Smith didn't just rely on the untrustworthy detectors. He had a whole slew of tricks.
You use all your other knowledge and techniques for doing what the crevasse detector doesn't do in terms of looking at small undulations in the snow. And so you would study this all very carefully and say, okay, this looks like the edge of a snow bridge. Now, where is the other edge of it?
The teams dynamited these weak snow bridges between the two firm sides of a crevasse, and then they'd bulldoze the blown-out snow and ice right back into the holes, like filling a pothole. In the end, the story of building the trail to Bird Station is as much about leadership as it is about engineering. Everyone on the project knew the danger they faced, especially since the year before, the Navy had attempted to build this trail and had lost a man down a crevasse. He was part of the construction battalion of the Navy. They were known as Seabees.
The biggest issue was a psychological problem. Some of the Seabees who were involved in building the station, part of our team of 11 people who put the trail together, had actually wintered over the preceding winter. They had attempted to start laying out this trail, and there was a major accident in which a very popular Seabee, Max Keel, and one of these 36 or 37 ton tractors went through a crevasse and he was killed. So all winter long, of course, the people who were his friends were there in isolation at Little America just thinking about this. And so one of my big challenges was to get this group of people to believe that we would, in effect, be able to bring this off.
Well, how did you do that? How did you build morale?
Well, you get people to believe in you and believe in the fact that you can do it. And we can do it. It's we can do it, not I can do it. It's we can do it.
They did. They pulled it off. And when they were done, they laid out a striking trail with markers made from strips of colored parachutes. They called it Fashion Lane. Fashion Lane was a milestone of the IGY. Without it, there'd be no Bird Station. And without Bird, we might as well just forget it. Scientists couldn't have made it into the interior of West Antarctica. IGY teams left from Bird to explore the unmapped ice sheet. They measured the depth of the ice and snow and conducted other research into the makeup of the ice. These journeys were called over-snow traverses. John Barrett took part in one across the Filchner Ice Shelf.
The purpose of the Antarctic Over-Snow Traverse Program was to measure the surface elevation of the ice sheet, the snow accumulation, the temperature, how thick it was, and what was the depth to bedrock underneath the ice sheet.
Barrett was an assistant seismologist based at Ellsworth Station. Now, seismology is the study of earthquakes and tectonics. That is, how elastic waves move through the earth, or in this case, through ice.
We would go out away from the station, lay out cables 1,000 feet in two directions from the snowcat, and we planted 24 small seismographs called geophones at wires protruding out from these cables.
Geophones are sensitive motion detectors. They register vibrations caused by sound waves.
Then we would fire an explosive charge.
And then they'd measure how long it took for the sound waves from the explosion to travel through the ice to the bedrock beneath it and then reflect back to the surface. This is a way to measure the thickness of the ice.
They'd come through the wires back into the snowcat, be amplified, filtered for the frequencies we were interested in.
And then the frequencies were recorded on photographic paper, right there, out in the field, in the god-awful polar weather. Sometimes the temperature could hit 30 below.
I'd collect 6 or 8 feet of this very sensitive photographic paper, and then I'd develop it by hand by rolling it back and forth in this tank of photographic solutions. Sometimes when heaters weren't working well, the records would freeze before I could write the data on the back of the record.
What a gig, huh? These days in Antarctica, data is usually recorded digitally. It's much easier on the fingers. But in 1957 and 1958, scientists did all sorts of observations under all sorts of conditions. Hugh Bennett and Ed Robinson took part in a traverse over the Ross Ice Shelf. Hugh Bennett.
We had glaciologists that did pit studies. We drilled to get ice cores. We did gravity. We did magnetics.
They took ice cores to get a history of Antarctic weather and also to investigate the microscopic structure of ice. The gravity readings measured differences in the ice thickness, which helped them chart buried mountains and valleys. And magnetism was part of the worldwide IGY investigation into the workings of the Earth's magnetic field. Ed Robinson.
The Traverse program was looking at examining, observing just about everything that we could think of to observe. Some of these, no one had ever been there before, and we didn't know if anyone would ever go back again. So we did the seismic echo sounding, the gravity readings, the magnetometer readings. And when we got near the mountains, we used to survey the positions of the mountain peaks, because a lot of that had never been done. There were no accurate positions for much of anything.
While Charlie Bentley, Ed Robinson, Hugh Bennett, and John Barrett were taking glaciological measurements, other IGY scientists, such as Tony Gao, were pioneering the technique of ice coring.
We took a 4-inch core from a 6-inch hole, and you'd go down 20 feet each time with a run, bring it up to the surface, lay it out on a light table, and start looking at the stratigraphy or the layer structure, which allows you to determine the annual cycling, because you can distinguish summer and winter layers year by year by year in succession. It's like just a horizontal filing cabinet. You just carry this tree ring analogy down through the ice.
Tony Gao makes it sound easy, but don't forget, these men were working in one of the most dangerous places on Earth. This is where the early explorer Ernest Shackleton almost died, and Robert Falcon Scott did die. And falling into a crevasse was a constant danger for the IGY scientists. In fact, Ed Robinson got his place on the Ross Ice Shelf Traverse after another man had a bad accident.
So I heard crevasse stories for the next month, because I was the new guy. To me, on the Traverse, the crevasse was a holy terror.
The story he heard over and over was the one about the scientist he replaced, Peter Schoik. Hugh Bennett helped save Schoik's life.
This was the third day out on the Traverse, and there was an argument between the photographer, Cal Larson. Cal said we were in a crevassed area, and Peter said, no, he's not in a crevassed area. He was a supposed crevasse expert, and in fact, they had a case of beer bet on it, whether we were or not. Peter Schoik and Walter Boyd went out, and no sooner had they gotten out the door than maybe 50 to 100 feet away, Peter had fallen in a crevasse.
Bennett rappelled down to rope Schoik in and pull him out, but he ended up getting pinned by the ropes to a ledge within the crevasse. He almost passed out from the pressure before he could cut himself free of Peter and get hauled back up.
And finally, I just grabbed a shovel and I started cutting the edge of the crevasse. And meanwhile, the snow was careening down onto Peter. I felt bad about that, but nevertheless, that was the only option. We finally got down to the rope, and we were able to get him back to the surface.
Schoik's injuries included several broken ribs, a cracked vertebra, a punctured lung, and a concussion. All the IGY traverse parties had close calls. Sometimes the snowcats, the vehicles, would tip into a crack in the ice. Ed Robinson.
Well, fortunately, the crevasses we broke into were relatively small, so that part of the vehicle would just slump in, and then you'd open the door and you'd look down 100 feet. But when we got in a crevasse area, two of us would have to walk ahead of the lead snowcat with these long, 10-foot-long poles and poke them in the snow and try to see if they were breaking through a bridge. And we were supposedly roped up, so if we fell in, the other one would catch us or something like that. But it was just scary.
What with the danger and the brutal cold and the tedious repetitive experiments, sometimes these IGY scientists just had to blow off some steam.
Well, yeah, one of my favorite stories is, it wasn't one I had anything to do with, but one of the weather people got it into his head that there were likely to be abominable snowmen or yetis in the Antarctic. And he was afraid that he was going to encounter one of these. So to help him along with his fear, the other weather people got together one night and they made up a giant foot, a wooden foot, and they stuck it on the end of a pole, and they went out and stamped footprints around the weather shelter. And then when this guy went out there, he found the footprints, and he was sure that there was a yeti and he was going to get him. And he would never, after that day, he refused to go out to the weather shelter without taking his revolver with him. Believe it or not, in IGY,
he had a revolver?
There was no rule against taking firearms to the Antarctic. And he had a revolver, and he wouldn't go out. He had to have his revolver with him whenever he went out to read the weather because he needed protection against the Yeti.
I was not involved in any of these things. I was there to push back the frontiers.
There you go. All kidding aside, the IGY did succeed in pushing back the frontiers of Antarctic science. Before the IGY, scientists only had theories about the land beneath the ice. Some thought Antarctica was two landmasses linked by a possibly joined Ross and Weddell seas. Others argued that the ice was shallow, that it just followed the contours of the mountains and valleys beneath it. It took the massive amount of data from the IGY to put these theories to rest. Now, one controversial theory turned out to be right. Continental drift had at some point broken apart an ancestral supercontinent in the southern hemisphere. John Barron.
Those of us who worked in Antarctica were forced to realize that Antarctica fit in with the other southern hemisphere continents. And the Dufek intrusion, which we discovered in the Dufek Massif, was part of the molten rock that had solidified when Africa was breaking apart from Antarctica, and then the rifting continued around the other continents, southern hemisphere continents rifted away. All of this we realized in the next few years. Other geophysicists were making other measurements in other parts of the world on the seafloor and various places throughout the world, but in a very short period, there was a paradigm shift in Earth science thinking in the world.
Assumptions about the ice itself were also turned on their heads.
Antarctica was known to be the highest continent just from a few field parties that worked interior, but some of the leading glacial geologists in the United States assumed that bedrock was shallow beneath this ice.
Charlie Bentley and his team made the discovery that proved this theory wrong once and for all.
We had a marked trail all the way to Bird Station, and we followed the trail and did our seismic measurements. And that's when we first found out that the bed of the West Antarctic ice sheet lies way, way below sea level. If you took the ice away, all this would be open water, open ocean. And that was a great surprise.
John Barron.
So when Charlie Bentley at Bird Station on a traverse from Little America Bird first measured 3,000 meters of ice on ice only 1,500 meters above sea level, in other words, about 2 miles of ice, this was so much greater than many scientists had thought. And this was the situation all over the Antarctic continent. So this was probably the most exciting accomplishments that now we know. I think it's 90% of the Earth's ice is in Antarctica, and that was not understood at all before the IGY.
So on the macro level, the IGY revealed the extent of the ice. On the microscopic level, the ice cores that glaciologist Tony Gao harvested revealed some of the secrets of compacted snow.
Turns out that the crystals increase in size according to a certain law, and that the orientation of the crystals changes. What the ice wants to do, it wants to create a crystal aggregate that is most acceptable to the flow of the ice.
Because the ice is going to flow in the path of least resistance, from the highest to the lowest point, down towards the sea. And the ice in a flowing glacier freezes and melts and refreezes and melts again. In other words, it recrystallizes due to the stress and the friction.
So it deforms itself and gets it into what they call the easy glide situation, which is the easiest way to flow the ice crystal. So all the flow of the ice is due to the integrated movement of these billions and billions of crystals. But they have to be oriented in a certain way to give you maximum benefit of flow.
Is that what was learned during the IGY
about
the structure of ice that was not known before?
That was known to a degree, but it wasn't done on large ice sheets. And even though flow laws were being generated, theoretically, the actual nature of the ice itself was not known. Nobody had looked at the ice structure.
The IGY officially ended in 1958, and the scientists it brought together scattered. Phil Smith went to Washington, D.C. to work for the National Academies of Science and eventually became the director of the National Research Council.
As we look back on it now, 50 years later, it changed, it revolutionized the understanding of the Earth and its surrounding space. It led to the Antarctic Treaty, of course, which is in itself a milestone.
John Barrett continued his work in Antarctica with more than 13 trips to the continent. He also wrote two memoirs about his IGY adventures. If you have a map of Antarctica handy, you can find the Barrett Mountains in Ellsworth Land.
Well, the United States Antarctic Program really took off with the IGY, and we have the continent has been continuously occupied by scientific stations of the U.S. and other countries since that time, and it has led to a great variety of scientific studies and biological and geological studies. So it opened up Antarctica for peaceful purposes.
Since the IGY, Charlie Bentley has made well over a dozen trips to Antarctica and helped lead the international group SCAR, the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research. You can find Mount Bentley in the Ellsworth Range as well.
Since these peaks had never been seen before, we suggested a lot of names, and then we had a lot of peaks left over, so we named a group after ourselves. We thought this was kind of a joke, but lo and behold, to our great surprise, it was accepted. So those peaks are still there. The Traverse group is still part of the Sentinel Mountains.
And Hugh Bennett continued his work in seismology. He's the author of classic reference books in geomagnetism and geophysics.
I remember Ed would drive. I would open the cab and sit up on top and listen to Radio India, for example, on the shortwave. And this would be a bright sunny day, and we're driving along with the sun shining off these snow crystals like diamonds and listening to this exotic music, and that just was a marvelous experience that I remember to this day. Yeah.
IGY On the Ice was produced by Barbara Bogave and mixed by Jared Weisbrot, with production assistance from Diane Belanger and Jude Goldberg. Archival tape courtesy of the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University. Thanks to Whitman College and Paul Dalrymple. Voiceover by Dan Balog of 3D Audio. The Pole to Pole music was composed by Alex Gardner. This airs as part of Pole to Pole, an international media celebration of the International Polar Year. This series is produced with support from the National Science Foundation. You can find the rest of Pole to Pole on our website, soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint can be purchased for a small fee. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES to order your favorite episodes. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love hearing from you. Your feedback makes these collaborations and our regular programming better. So drop us a line at talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.